This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Sandy Chilowich. And I pronounced that right.
You
I'm excited about that. Chilowich, Chilewich.com is your company, is your last name. But it was a long journey, a lot of professions to actually get to the point of what you do now, developing textiles and tabletops and patterns alike. Where did this start? Where did you grow up, and what kind of tabletops and design things were you into?
Well, tabletop and design was not in my early childhood, and I certainly didn't have dreams of designing placemats in my old age.
That would be fun, though, like in kindergarten. What do you want to do when you grow up?
Make placemats.
Placemat designer.
Yeah, I want to be a placemat designer. So when people ask me now, and you know how I got here, because they're at the young age of, let's say, 22, they feel that they're supposed to have it all figured out, and I look at them like they're crazy, you know, because I certainly had no idea what I was going to do. But I did have an unusual kind of geographical upbringing. I was born in Westchester.
Oh, whereabouts?
In Mount Vernon, New York.
I only ask because I'm from Croydon.
Ah.
Yeah, a damn town.
Yeah, well, that's pretty.
Yeah.
And at five, we moved to Holland. So I lived in Europe for 5 years. So my primary education and my first written language was actually Dutch. Which it was not. I have no fond memories of living in Holland, going to Dutch school, and I certainly, within 6 months of having moved back to America, and being in fourth grade, I wanted to repress everything that I
shed
had.
Those wooden clogs and tulips.
Absolutely, and that
no more
and
windmills.
That language.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
You know. So, but what I was exposed to early on is, I guess, eating and like having amazing food because we traveled all the time. So I think I was exposed to food early on, although that certainly wasn't going to be what I thought my profession would be.
And I'm sure design aesthetic too. I mean, Scandinavian design is kind of, and cuisine are both at the forefront right now. So
they are.
You must have soaked something in then. Or
you know what? I don't think it had anything to do with where I ended up in my life. I really don't.
Yeah.
But I think. Looking at disparate cultures, and I think all of that, just visually, the mix of stuff and the foreignness of stuff, you know, I became comfortable.
Yeah. And where else did you travel in Europe?
Oh, God, we went everywhere, from Istanbul to Austria to, you know, the usual places. We traveled everywhere.
Yeah. So. And then coming back to the United States.
Yeah, that was a big culture shock. I mean, in a way, when my youngest kid was in first grade or something, they did a study on immigration, and they had their typical immigrant stories. My grandfather came here from Russia or whatever, and I came in and spoke about immigrating as a five-year-old in a way to Holland and then immigrating back to the U.S. And actually, I was definitely a showstopper. They could relate to, you know, a five-year-old's experience. So what was the question? It was tough, you know. All I wanted to do was fit in and have friends. I mean, I was, you know. But the one thing I have to say, from a very early part of my life, probably soon after I moved back to the States, so around 9-10 years old, I always did artwork. I mean, I always made stuff. That was kind of what I did when I was depressed or anxious or whatever. It was kind of a solitary outlet. So I always did artwork while I was trying to actually, you know, get through school, which was definitely I am the best example. I was kicked out of a lot of schools. I was kind of delinquent. I barely got out of high school. They wouldn't even write me a recommendation for college. Oh, yeah. And I went to many colleges. I didn't go to anything for a couple of years. Then I tried many schools, dropped out of them all, and never got a degree.
Yeah.
So I like that to be my introduction when I speak to students, that, I didn't really have an education. And I really mean, I am ignorant. I mean, totally ignorant.
Yeah.
Because I didn't understand Dutch when I was in Dutch school. I didn't understand English when we came back. So I don't know how I got by.
Yeah, but I mean, you inherently knew something to be able to form a business eventually.
Oh, no. Yeah. Then I got kind of smarter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I did.
What was that point where you realized, well, there's something that I want to do and this is how I do it?
Well, you know, even that's not so simple. You know, I thought as I was clamoring in my early 20s, what is that I want to do? Dropping in and out of things, working here and there, I always did my artwork, and I thought, oh, maybe I'm a fine artist.
Yeah.
So I sent my artwork to like a ton of New York galleries, and it completely ignored by most.
Yeah.
And
what mediums were you working in?
Collage and sculpture.
Yeah.
So it was a combination of different materials. And, you know, as I said, you know, most people didn't even respond to me. Most of the others just rejected me. But this one gallery said, come on in. They were on 57th Street, and I cannot remember the name. But they were a prestigious gallery. And I go in there, and he takes out my portfolio, because I had sent him slides, and he turned to me, and he said it without the slightest sound of meanness, but it felt like an attack. He said, you know, your work is very commercial. Have you ever thought about being a commercial artist? And I walked down 57th Street like in tears.
Yeah,
you know?
For the emotive artist, God, that must be the worst thing.
Death, you know. So it's not because I listened to him, but I also found myself at the same time thinking, well, I'm making these things, you know, this kind of sculpture. Why don't I try to make some jewelry? So I was designing some jewelry, and I was going to the store and selling the jewelry to the stores. And then I met somebody in the building that we lived in NoHo. This is in the 70s.
Yeah.
This is before SoHo was really born. We were trying to buy the building because we were all artists living in this building because it was for sale. And through that process, I met a neighbor of mine. Meanwhile, I'm designing jewelry. She was an art teacher. And we had this idea because we were looking in our closets and there were these Chinese, we used to buy them in Chinatown. It was cheap chic back then. They were the black Mary Jane's cotton shoe with a rubber sole for $3.99
at
work in Chinatown.
Yeah, I think they still sell those at Pearl River. Yeah,
where? Well, say that
at
again?
Pearl River.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. They sell them. Well, back then, you know, they were $3.99, and we thought, God, these would be so cool if they came in colors, and we bleached them out one night when we were like drunk after a meeting. one of us had Chloris, one of us had Tintex, and we said, let's go back down there and get some more of these, which we did. I had an appointment with Vogue magazine to show them my jewelry, and we decided to bring the shoes in. It was like drop dead. This was the editor of Vogue, Grace Mirabella, who was the one before Anna Wintour. She was there for years, and between Diana Vreeland and Anna Wintour was Grace Mirabella. I mean, she walked into the room and she said, oh, my God, we're going to Sardinia on Monday. This is Friday. We need all of these things that you brought in size 10 for models. So we're thinking, can you do it? Yeah, we can do it. We had no idea, like, what she was talking about. We go to Chinatown, and we're scrambling to try to find size 10 in Chinatown. So we're buying these crates of shoes where there's one size 10 and the rest are, like, 5.5, 4.5, 3.5. And we spent the weekend dyeing up these shoes. And we came in Monday morning, we were hair drying it, and off they went to Sardinia, and they gave us 2 pages in Vogue magazine saying, well, what's the name of your company and who do you sell to? Meanwhile, Kathy's working full time as a teacher. You know, we didn't know what we were doing, but that's my story, is we didn't know what we were doing, and we had no plan. But we went from making these shoes, and in my loft, we set up washing machines. We were working all night long. We started to import shoes in white directly from China because they wore white for funerals and black for every day. So at least we didn't have to bleach out the black. We bought them in white. We brought in 20,000 of these shoes, and in our own loft, we're like dyeing these up and shipping them to Macy's and Bergdorf Goodman. Shoes that were $3.99 were now $16 because we had to strip them down, dye them, package them, put new clips on them. Anyway, we got massive amounts of press. Again, we're not making a dime, but we're getting great press and sales are good, but we have all this inventory. And we decided, all the editors were saying, what else do you do? So we went down to Orchard Street and bought things that were never available in color, gloves and other accessories. And one of them were these cotton nurse's stockings. And we said, oh, let's offer these in lots of colors. And we got, I mean, pages of Mademoiselle and Glamour and Vogue, all these magazines showing all this. So we got really interested in these stockings. And because all these women, this is now back in the late 70s, there were no cotton tights out there. There were no natural fiber tights. They just had Danskin, you know, nylon tights. And we started to focus in, to make a really long story short, on the fact that, hey, there was a market here for natural fiber stretch tights. And slowly but surely, the shoes disappeared and we became a hosiery company because there was nobody in that field doing a great job.
So Hugh was born.
Hugh was born without any plan. But as we went along, we learned very, very quickly all the mistakes we were making and how to correct them. So we started Hugh in 1978.
You and Kathy
Moskal. Me and Kathy Moskal. And it was quite a journey because we started, and when we sold the company, we were doing $40 million. And at the beginning, I mean, we really, really were in total neophytes.
Yeah.
And so we sold it in 1991, stayed on for a couple of years to help them with the transition, and then we left. But I had, you know, a vast amount of experience with starting something from scratch.
Yeah.
And
but also in design and packaging and merchandise now, too.
All of those things. I mean, I had such an education. However, when I sold, again, I was back at, I don't know what I want to do. I knew I wanted to do something, and I decided to kind of create some of the ideas I had and bring it to as close to real life prototype as possible, so that I could kind of gauge whether or not this had, you know, commercial potential. I mean, one thing I realized very early on at Hugh was that I didn't want to be an artist. I really didn't. I really like the commercial aspect of design and the business of design. That's really my passion. I'm not interested in making one thing. And I also, I mean, I just said this somewhere that what I love is the interchange between me and an audience. And it's kind of keeping my integrity, my design integrity, but also adapting and compromising to a degree so that it is commercially successful. And it's that kind of striving to balance those two. When I hit that right note is when I'm happiest.
Yeah.
You know, that's my goal.
Well, I mean, you think of something like shoes or hosiery or Chilowich now, tabletops, placemats. They're also modular. You're giving somebody a piece of their larger self or, you know, a larger picture and letting them interpret from this base product.
That's a nice way to look at it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of an amazing building block to give somebody. And, I mean, you created these building blocks and these businesses from nothing and it must be amazing to walk into a space that uses your product or see someone walking down the street still wearing your hosiery and seeing what else they dress with or how
it's just
else.
A part. It's just a part of the whole picture. You know, I've never looked at it like that. And in fact, the placemats, I often wonder, there's kind of, people have this passion for these placemats. I mean, there's like a, no, you know, not everybody, like there's like this, such a passion, and I think it's because of what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's a little piece of like art or textile that they can play with, and let it work within their home and stuff. That's very true.
Yeah. I think it's great. I remember the first time I actually saw one of your products on a table. It was at Room for Dessert that opened up, I think, in 2004, 2005, down in Soho. Chef Will Goldfarb outfitted the whole place, I think, almost completely with Chilowich. All the placemats, and I looked at this material.
Was that the first time you saw that?
I think so, I see. I mean, I don't think I had an eye for design or even understood what kind of food and design world I was in until then.
Right.
But seeing this, it was kind of like being let in on a secret.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was cool seeing something and this material that you use and the process that you make it. I just couldn't even visualize how it was done.
Right.
Kind of like how Will's desserts were at that restaurant.
Right.
But I mean, the process, the materials for Chilliwack came out of hosiery.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, the transition period between selling Hue and starting and what I'm doing now, there was a little brief couple of years in between. First, a couple of years to figure out what I was going to do, and then a couple of years to actually do that transition, which were the Ray Bowls. And that was actually using hosiery in a way. It's a stretch lycra mesh and stretching it over these wire frames. And I created a concavity so it became a receptor and a container by simply pulling the stretch material down in the center. And that simple mechanism that is like looks like a complete no-brainer, actually nobody had done it before, and I got all these utility patents and things that you can get design patents, but getting mechanical patents and for something that simple, it's kind of crazy. But I was using hosiery material. Again, it wasn't conscious. I just found myself attracted to stretchy materials and then realized in retrospect that's why. But it was from the Ray Bowls, which I designed, and then it was MoMA that introduced them. That I got a taste now of the design world. I had been in the fashion world up until then. And I knew also when I sold Hue, I didn't really want to be in fashion anymore. When I always say to people, like when I used to open the New York Times, the magazine section years back, I would always go to the home section before I would go to fashion. I just like that better. So anyway, so the bowls are going along, and I was looking for other materials, which I started to play with, to incorporate into this kind of container structure. And one of them, I had this idea for doing this picnic basket, which is where I found the manufacturer for this woven vinyl material, which was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I've become, it's been a love affair with this company. Which is a very large company, but it's the woman that owns it and, took it over from her dad who founded it. She's about my age. We're from different worlds, but there was a great bond, and it's really a big company. They do window screening. I mean, they're big.
Yeah, I mean, vinyl, I think of sidings of houses. And,
right.
You know.
Well, but this is soft vinyl.
Yeah,
this is woven vinyl.
Yeah.
But they also do metal window screening and stuff. They're like commodity stuff. But anyway, so I discovered the material. I went to their plant, and I just became kind of, I fell in love with what I love about this material is, aside from the design potential of the material, because there's so many things about it that provide this kind of unlimited design potential, is its functionality, which is what captivated me, because it's really hard to get those things together. I mean, I love beautiful things. We all love, precious, expensive, limited, hard to maintain stuff. But this was, and I do think when people see the placemat, one of the reasons why it's so successful is that when you look at it, you can tell I can clean it. And there's something about that instant recognition that's very, very
durable,
special.
Washable,
yeah.
Utilitarian.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick break on that and come back and see how woven vinyl launched Chilliwack onto the top tables in New York.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
All of us at Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network, the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Sandy Chilowich. Tabletops.
Yeah.
Placemats. Came from woven vinyl. Finding this thing in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, right, of all places. Right. Having this relationship with this manufacturer. Initially, from the concept of Ray Bowles. How did it transition to placemats? Because, like we were joking before, that's never something you grow up saying.
Right.
I want to be a placemat designer.
Right, right. Well, when I found the material, it just seemed like, I don't know how it occurred to me. It just seemed like, you know, it, because of its functionality, because it was so instantly understandable that this material could wash it so easily. I don't know how it came to me that, hey, this could be a great placemat, because at the same time as the placemats, I also was making bags with the material. I tried shoes with them. I tried to play with a million different things.
Yeah.
That placemat just somehow by trial and error appeared like, hey, this is like really good.
Yeah.
But I was also selling bags at the time. I was trying to back the material to make floor mats. And then, you know, it was around this time that my husband, who's an architect, had his own practice. I was in a one-room studio. And that's the other thing. Here I was, I don't know, my 40s, like 40, I was probably 44, 46, I think. And here I was starting completely over from scratch, and I love that. I mean, I wonder what's going to happen if I ever sell this company. You know, will I be alive so that I can start something else from scratch? But anyway, so, you know, and then it just like it, Hugh, you know, I knew more than I did then when I started. But there also, you know, it's like I had to sell to stores. I had to go to trade shows. But the food-related part, what happened was a caterer in New York, her name is Susan Holland. She's like a very, I mean, she is, you know, just a gorgeous kind of event designer and extremely aesthetic. And she found the product at one of the trade shows and said, you know, I'd like to use this as tray liners when I'm doing events. So we sold her some stuff for that. And I saw it maybe at another show. And she recommended it to Tom Colicchio, or the woman that manages her name is Katie. When he hadn't opened his first restaurant, Kraft.
Yeah.
She mentioned to her, you know, you should think about these placemats for the restaurant. And I had never thought of it.
Yeah.
It was just, that just happened. And so they ordered the placemats for the restaurant, and it was a sensation. I mean, the New York Times did this wonderful piece right around then where they talked about the placemats, you know, where'd this come from? And they interviewed a Katie or Tom, I don't know. And they said when they opened it, and I forget the name of the designer that did that first restaurant, I just drew a blank, that they were complaining that people would come in and they wouldn't comment on the fact that they spent God knows how many millions on the place. They just said, so where do you get these placemats? So that kind of launched me into the hospitality world.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to do anything after that in terms of that. I mean, restaurant, it just spread like fire.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, this is a functional way to cover. And also it coincided, I think, with what was happening. It used to be that, you know, it was linen tablecloths that defined fine dining, where now people start to expose the table. And so the placemats kind of fit right into that.
Yeah.
So you weren't covering an ugly table. You were actually exposing a beautiful one.
So. Yeah. So, I mean, you're in Terrace 5 at the MoMA, as well as the MoMA, and we'll discuss that in a second.
Yeah.
Other restaurants, Le Anima in London, were some of your first clients.
Yeah.
How many restaurants do you think you sell to?
Oh, my God. I don't know.
Yeah.
All over the world?
Yeah.
And when you think about, like, let's say the Four Seasons and all the Four Seasons, like, on the room service trays and stuff, like 1,000 maybe?
Wow. Yeah.
I have no idea.
So, I mean, do you go out?
I'm not going to fact check, are you?
Yeah. No. I throw out numbers. So I have a default number. I'd say 20 to everything.
Okay, good.
So your thousands are much better than mine. Do you eat out a lot in New York? I mean, do you go into restaurants and see your wares on the table?
I do. It's always fabulous to kind of be surprised like that, because there are people that copy us, Which at first was like an absolutely nauseating.
Oh, I always thought that was the imitation flattery thing.
Yeah, I mean, does anyone really believe that?
No,
I mean,
not at all.
It's horrible. People used to say that to me. So especially, I mean, and all the copies are made out of Asia, and you know, we have suits going on everywhere and legal bills, and sometimes we just walk away. It's just not worth it. But when I travel, especially in Asia or whatever, you can see some copies, which is not a, you know, it's a very especially if the property is gorgeous, and they don't even know. I mean, they don't know that there was an original and that there is an authentic author here. You know, but in general, the if it's a really nice restaurant, they've got placemats. It'll be our placemats, and that's it's a very very satisfying.
Yeah,
I love it.
So you were just on the road, I think at the houseware shows in Chicago. But prior to that, were you in Asia?
Yes, I was just in Asia.
Yeah, yeah. Looking at new textiles, looking
no,
at new patterns.
No, I wish. I wish. You know, this was more of a sales kind of press junket.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So, no, it was Beijing, Seoul, Taipei, and Tokyo.
But when you eat out at these places and maybe even see your placemats in some of these restaurants, do you see them interact with them differently? I mean, are placemats different throughout the world?
No, I think what I love about it is how unifying it is. You know, it's who would think, you know, placemats could really bring the world together. You know, I'm at these international trade shows, you know, and I cried the first time this happened when we do this international show in Germany twice a year. And I'm standing there, and there must be like 8 languages going on, you know, with placemats flying. I mean, it's like, it's universal. And I think it's because you look at it and you get it.
Yeah.
And there is something about that I am most proud of, that it's really, you don't need any explanation.
Yeah.
And it's very clear.
It was funny. I think I was going to use the word utilitarian.
Yeah.
Which it is, but I like unifying that much more.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's some kind of more iconic thing than just, you know, the trudges of everyday. Utilitarian feels kind of pedestrian
sometimes. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
So you took something that was maybe pedestrian and rose it to that aesthetic level.
Yes.
Do you look at other things on the table and say, I want to change that, I want to change that?
I don't know if it's like, do I look at other things on the table? Honestly, it's more like I look at processes that I feel have potential. It's underutilized. So it's more manufacturing processes that really, really excite me.
Yeah.
And kind of breakthroughs where, you know, I'll find a process that is like so pedestrian and so ugly. And then actually make it look beautiful by changing it. So it's more processes. Of course, what happens when you're in business, and that's one of the, you know, challenges of being in the business of design, is that you can't do all. I have a lot of ideas that are outside of the table, but I can't do that. You know, if I want to survive and make a living doing what I love to do or staying in the design world, then I have to kind of restrict myself to some degree. But I am thinking of ways to expand, but it would revolve around entertaining and food
to have
it make sense.
I think it's fascinating what you just said, because it is so analogous to what I've been learning lately about food and larger industries that have to have a protocol in place to be able to serve specific foods.
Right.
That you can't just make this beautiful one-off dish and that be, I mean, you can, and that be so mind-blowingly good and that it changes the rest of cuisine as we know it. Sometimes
you can't do that?
I mean, you can and you can't, but sometimes it's these processes that we feel are like rote and mundane, and by tweaking those and making those better, that's sometimes a bigger effect than just...
You know what? I feel designing within constraints is where you're the most creative. I've always felt that way.
Yeah.
If you tell me you can do whatever you want, I'm paralyzed completely.
Yeah.
And the more restricted you make it, the more creative I can be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
no,
yeah.
It's just a fascinating corollary to
But I was thinking about what you were saying, though, that does a restaurant... You know, a restaurant, their cuisine is kind of their brand. So I can see that they... maybe are they restricted in the way, like, they can't start making chili now, even though they've got like a great, you know, a fabulous chili idea if their restaurant is country French, yeah, right? So kind of they can't do that probably either.
Yeah, I guess it's hard because you have to do like an interpretive chili, maybe yeah, something resonant of whatever country French cassoulet yeah, slash chili
right
thing.
Make it look like steak tartare.
Oh,
or something.
Yeah, yeah. Some, yeah, something. But I mean, that's how you kind of reinvented yourself.
That's right. That's right. And so within those constraints.
Yeah. So, I mean, you talk about food and entertaining and new ideas of design and processes within that. Are you allowed to preview some of those ideas that you want to launch?
Well, I think probably the most exciting thing for me, but it's so in a way the opposite of what I've been saying to some degree. I've been very, let me say, kind of inspired to make a product that was kind of universally accepted and accessibly priced. Granted, it's on the higher end spectrum of price points, but it's still affordable because even the most expensive placemat is $20, you know, and I'm at the top of the line. You know, that's not so bad in the grand scheme of things, whereas most of the placemats are more like 10, 12. But, you know, I've been loving working with those constraints, and I will continue to work with those constraints. But I realized I would want to try to make something where I'm not thinking about price point at all.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make what I absolutely want to make. And you know what? I earned that. I mean, I can do that now after, like, doing this for, you know, 15 years. And I'm designing a line that is absolutely gorgeous. And all of it, I think about functionality, because none of it's going to have to get dry cleaned, and none of it's going to have to be, you know, it won't be an expensive process to clean it, but it's very luxurious. It's going to be very expensive, but with no compromise. And that's going to be a very interesting introduction with probably a different sub name. And I think that restaurants are going to love it.
Yeah.
Because it distinguishes them from all the other restaurants. And, personally, it's the most exciting thing I'm doing.
Excellent.
Right now.
And yeah. I like the elusiveness of this discussion because I'm so excited to know when it comes out and what it will be. When is this product
I'll launch this next fall. Yeah, so we're... So, no, fall 13.
Yeah.
When is that? Like
yeah, that's next
yeah,
fall.
Yeah, next fall. Yeah.
I don't know what day it is today. Tuesday.
when
I air my show. But I can't wait to see how you're going to reinvent the tabletop or the placemat again. One thing I kind of gloss over is some shapes, colors, patterns that you use. Kyoto, Kono, Dahlia, Cowhide, Leaf. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are textures or colors or patterns that you use on your placemats. Obviously inspired by nature and food and culture. Is that how you draw inspiration for these things?
I do think that I am inspired by history and textiles through history, although I'm hardly academically educated in that arena. But I think I've absorbed a lot imagery-wise and nature. But it's everything. Honestly, I think that I'm more inspired by, you know, the dirty hem of somebody's skirt in a subway, in all honesty, and like somehow like the color that makes, than I am about going to a palace and looking at fabrics behind a case. So it could be anything. Again, I mean, all the things that you mentioned, they're not all woven vinyl. When you mentioned Dahlia,
yeah,
that's an example of finding a process that used to make the ugliest stuff imaginable. It was the stuff your great-grandmother used to make. It used to have doilies out of plastic. I mean, it was really god-awful ugly. And I had samples of this kind of crap in my studio for years. And it hit me that I could use that process and make... It's molded. It's a molding process. And I went to Taiwan it took me like a year, you know, to get them to do what I was asking because it was unfathomable to them to make black, you know, modern laces and dots. Anyway, I'm so proud of that, of taking that process and transforming it so it's almost unrecognized. It is unrecognizable. You'd never know it was the same process. So there is an example. I mean, it's not just woven vinyl, but again, this product, you just rinse it off.
Yeah.
You know, that it has to have that.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. I think, again, so analogous to just thinking about food, reinterpreting something as, you know, simple and something that we just gloss over as the placemat to make it so engaging, right, again is a right, fantastic thing, and it must be,
well, thank you.
Great to know that that niche has opened up the world to you.
Thank you.
And, you know, finally making your grandma's doilies sheep chic again. Thank you again, Sandy,
okay,
for being on Chilowich.
Yep.
.com and fall 2013 for a very interesting new product.
Okay.
I'll be watching for that, and definitely we'll have you back.
Okay.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website. Thanks for listening.